I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:03 p.m. Today is Wednesday, the 28th of February. Members present are Representative Birch, Representative Drummond, Representative Johnson, Representative Parrish, Representative Rauscher, Representative Tallarico, Vice Chair Representative Lincoln, Co-Chair myself, Representative Josephson, and so we are short just one member at the moment. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Deborah Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Eileen Keim. I remind members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones, and I tend to check my own. This afternoon, we have two items on our agenda. First, we have a presentation by the Minerals Commission, and I welcome you gentlemen. And then we'll be taking up House Bill 355. Presenting for the commission, we have in the room Dr. Lance Miller, and Rob Rutherford. Gentlemen, if you put yourselves on the record, and you may begin your presentation. And members, I'd ask that we pose questions after each slide. Thank you for being here.
Okay, well, thank you for the committee here and the opportunity to present. So again, for the record, my name is Lance Miller, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I work for Nano Regional Corporation, and this year I'm the chair of the Alaska Minerals Commission.
And I'm Rob Rutherford. I also live in Anchorage. I own a company called Alaska Earth Sciences. We're consultants primarily to the minerals industry, occasionally energy, and had the opportunity to work on Sweetheart Lake last summer for an engineering aspect of our company. So I'm a member of the Minerals Commission.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. So what we thought we'd do, and appreciate the rules on after each slide, but as you'll see, we'll get to the recommendations. We just have broken those up into two slides and, you know, open to questions on that. We thought we'd go through the recommendations fairly quickly because a lot of the details in the report. And then from feedback from talking to some of the folks on the commission and also co-chair Tarr and others, we have a few slides about the industry and just kind of the structure of it. And I don't think it'll be duplicative of all of presentations of Alaska miners or Council Alaska producers, because we'll be looking at a different level. So just a bit more introduction as far as, let me make sure, there we go. The next slide is the Minerals Commission. I guess a big point is everybody is appointed, so it's not a trade group. And also there tries to be distribution around the state and by industry. A rural seat, representatives of placer mining, coal mining, regional corps, metallic metal mining. So try to have a broad coverage of the industry and the issues around it. It has, well, I also would like to say we've gotten great support from Division of Economic Development as well. One other point is, in case you're looking at your report, there is somebody who, this is a report for really this last year. Steve Buckley was a member, and now he is actually become a state employee, so he will be no longer on the commission.
And a short note on the role that we play is primarily to look for constraints or other problems that address the mineral system. So with that in mind, as you go forward, we want to be sure that you understand that we're also here to support your efforts and applaud them where necessary, as well as the agencies.
Okay, thank you. And just an outline of, I already sort of covered this, but we'll talk about the priorities that we've broken into. There's a top priority, state priorities, and federal priorities. And then, you know, when it comes to industry overview, I think there's been, you just hear a lot in the Capitol about different projects and where they are. So I thought we'd put that into frame of timeline of projects, competition for capital globally, metal cycles, majors and juniors, the difference there, infrastructure approaches by jurisdictions, benefits, and how we compete globally. So with that, the first action priority, which has been on our list for a few years, is establishment of a stable state fiscal policy. So I don't think we need to talk too much about that, because you probably hear a lot about that. But I think just to sort of highlight that it really is important when you're trying to get businesses to attract capital, but also just for the long term, because that's one of the things they look at besides the great geology that we'll talk about. And all the recommendations that will follow really flow up into this as far as having that kind of stable environment.
Yeah, I would only add that the same words you hear from other industry people as well as everything you discuss, I'm sure, consistency in policy, long-term view, these are things that are very important to the mining industry. And those can apply to taxes, of course, to permitting in particular. Permitting is extremely important in terms of the timing of those events. You'll see more from Lance's presentation.
Okay. So on the state priorities, the number two is, this says reallocate portions of the state mining license tax to communities. We all know the issues that come up when there's development in a certain jurisdiction and making sure the communities feel like they're benefiting from it. Often the company works with that community, whether it's Red Dog or whatever, and makes, you know, that happen. But I think, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty, and we saw that last year with severance taxes. So one approach could be is that some of the money that comes from the mining license tax actually does flow back to the communities. In return, much like the North Slope did, you could basically, the legislature could prevent, the local government's ability to impose severance tax, but of course not at all preclude their ability for a tax, for a property tax. So these are some things to consider, because severance taxes can be really a no-go for a company coming in. Okay. Number three is, I think you were going to talk to that, Rob.
Yeah, that was a quick shift. Okay.
It was. Unless there's questions. Again, if you have questions on any of these, since we're not going slide, we're going to just run through each of these and then go slide by slide. Okay. So just ask us, please.
Again, and applaud the efforts that the administration as well as the legislature has done in these trying times to be strong advocates for industry, and particularly for minerals. What we do see is that we want to make sure that there is strong support for your agencies. It's easy at times with the political pressures to second guess what our agencies are doing. I certainly don't want to get into details, but our primary agencies that we deal with, from DEC to DNR to many of the others, have excellent people on board. I think that you have and will continue to use their services, but we just support that, and we also ask the governor and wherever else possible to reach out to let especially the large companies know that we are open to business. I think that message has been put out there, and we want to underline that that effort goes a very long ways to helping the minerals industry.
Yes, sorry, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just through the chair to you. So I see it says, encourage the governor's administration to challenge ballot initiatives that seek to regulate natural resource development. Do you have anything in mind? I mean, are we talking about potentially, I mean, do you have a position then on HB 199?
Yeah, thank you for that. So that's great segue to the next point.
Okay.
I think. Yeah. Is, I mean, specifically on the Stand for Salmon initiative, I mean, in our view, it would be just really detrimental to rural economic development, never mind mining. And I think some you've heard about other the issues around that. So the Minerals Commission position on that is we, you know, applaud the administration for challenging that. But maybe for the legislature more broadly is the initiative process in general. Is that the right place to make policy decisions, especially natural resource policy decisions? Again, you know, you have some pretty good agencies working for you, really good people in them, and that's kind of where a lot of that should really come up through. So we just, you know, you see how other states this has gone, in California and places. So to have these kind of science-based technical decisions being made at the ballot box, we would like the legislature to think about maybe changing that approach. Does that answer that question? Sort of?
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Except that it would, I think, require some constitutional change.
I believe it would.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. So, yes, and I know that, and there's issues, I realize, about opening that up. Do we even want to? Can you? But I think we all recognize it is a challenge. So that's the main point on number four, though.
Okay.
Number five, and this, there's a couple different water use issues here, and really like you to focus on really the first two bullets. And I don't know if folks are how familiar are with anti-degradation and water quality, but Tier 3 waters are really waters that should have no degradation whatsoever. And to have that waterway designated as such, we believe that it should be the legislature that does that. I think some people say, well, that might be too political, but again, you know, the way the system, it seems like, should work is you have agencies, they do the science, they make recommendations, and then it's up to the legislature. And that could take it out of the hands of other, you know, special interest groups. So that would be the point on Tier 3. And then sort of similar, on a similar vein, in-stream flow reservations for water, we believe that those should be granted to the state of Alaska, not to an NGO or a private interest group, whatever they may be. Because again, that, you know, and I'm no expert there, but if it comes to appropriation of state resources, that's, you know, clearly what would be a state resource. So again, would be best served to reside in the state of Alaska.
Just that it's a balance. Obviously, at times, industry has to be constrained. So if we wanted a water, an in-stream, an IFR, in-stream flow restriction, then we could apply for one. But as a balancing act, it seems like the agencies should be the ones who have the final say.
Okay, and
I think you make a good point, and I think it's shared by some members of the administration. It reminds me of the House Bill 77 debate, which I think was 2013. There was quite a bit of public uproar about it, and the bill collapsed. But certainly the debate continues.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
And it will.
Yeah.
Thanks. You know, I can't help but we had a third bullet we weren't going to talk about. We thought Representative Tarr might bring it up, but given her background, but she's not here. Just to highlight, there is something out there. It's related to human health criteria, and this is, again, something that EPA is telling the state of Alaska they have to come up with specific water quality standards for about 96 different elements and chemicals. And what it means is that there is a amount of fish that you can consume per day, and right now it's around 6.5 grams of fish, which is like a little palmful, as close as we could figure. That includes salmon. The issue with this, it's a little complicated, but and I'm still trying to understand it fully, but basically it's metals and things, whether it's zinc or cadmium or selenium, that end up in fish, mercury. But salmon are included, as can be marine mammals. But most of the lives of those critters is actually not in fresh water. So how much does that fresh water influence have on the metal intake on these mammals and fish? Okay, so, and what the bottom line of what it could mean to water quality is that if you, as you lower the consumption rate, as you higher the consumption rate of the fish you intake, you're going to, if you go by these specific criteria for the amount of, say, selenium, then you're going to have to lower the water quality, not lower, but lower the detection limits for the water quality standards. Okay? It basically may make it impossible to permit a wastewater treatment plant, things like that. So it's a finicky thing. There's a working group put together with a bunch of different representatives from industry and NGO groups and agencies on this very topic. So it's in progress right now, but I think it's something to bring to your attention just to track. It goes kind of, it's intertwined with the anti-degradation issues.
Just a note, Mr. Nakanishi, who's with your DEC group, has been spending a lot of time on this and gave us a very excellent presentation at the Minerals Commission in Fairbanks. So I would listen to what your DEC folks are saying on that.
Okay, and the last comment was from Mr. Rutherford, for the record.
Yeah. Okay. So again, it's another one of these nuanced things with a lot of science. And the takeaway on that I have written here, the human health criteria are really intended to protect the public from chemical uptake through drinking water, fish consumption, and other exposure routes for waterborne chemicals. And the focus has been on fish consumption. So, and we all know we eat a lot of fish. So, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this. What you're saying is that this may be that we're talking about fish getting an increase in minerals in freshwater, where they may actually be getting them in when they go on out to the ocean, and who knows where they have what flume or plume they happen to be swimming through, and then came back, and it may not be part of the freshwater. There's surely some science that indicates that already.
That's exactly the point.
Okay.
Yes. And there is science, but what I understand is EPA originally said, you know, the daily consumption could be like 175 grams, including salmon, and then they've changed it. So, yes, there is a lot of science, but there's still a lot of pushback because you're getting the different, frankly, user or special interest groups trying to use it to their advantage. But that's the way I understand it, that's the key thing. The salmon aren't even feeding much once they enter freshwater. They're living in the salt and then are trying to apply the water quality standards to the freshwater.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had thought that Alaska salmon, I mean, I know there's always been the concern about mercury and fish elsewhere, but I had thought Alaska salmon was not quite as, you know, that wasn't a problem as much with Alaska fish. Is that true?
I'd be speaking out of my area of expertise. I believe, yes, that is true as a general statement. The issue is it's not so much actually the metal content. It comes down to the fish consumption levels that are
yes, okay,
national. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Drummond. Yeah.
Thank you. This is really interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, did you say that the limit, the recommended limit of consumption is 6.5 ounces or 175 grams?
It's actually 6.5 grams per person per day is the current rate.
And what is that called? The recommended maximum consumption, something
I'm
like
sure
that?
I could get back to you guys on that.
EPA
originally had excluded, salmon, and they had 175 grams per day.
Yeah, that's the same, six and a half ounces or 175
grams.
Try to come back through here just so the record's clear.
Yeah, so 6.5 grams is the current rate per day, and then originally EPA had 175 grams.
There's something weird about those numbers, because 6.5 grams is less than a quarter of an ounce.
I know.
That's crazy.
That's exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody needs to be looking
at
that.
That's exactly the danger. Or the
follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, follow-up.
There are these minerals that show up in fish and other seafood, and they're showing up in breast milk. They're showing up in all kinds of places where they don't originate from. So there is a valid concern about this, but and this is really important. So I'm glad that there is a working group on it, and I hope you have all the disciplines represented. So, you know, from the health folks to the minerals producers, so that we can come to a rational place to be on that, because you're never going to limit Alaskans to eating a quarter of an ounce of salmon a day. That's just crazy. So.
I know. That's why I know it's hard to believe. I know it's hard to get your
arms. Right. Yeah, I heard the numbers, and I started writing them down and doing the math, and I go, what?
I know.
That's crazy. Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. We're happy to follow up if there's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But. Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. What work has been done to get a correlation between the mineral load, the mercury, selenium, was it, et cetera, in fish with whether or not their stream of origin has got a load of heavy metals in it?
Mr. Rutherford.
Yeah, I guess I can attempt an answer, and it's a difficult one. I think the essential problem is that we have a lot of rivers and streams in Alaska, and there tends to be focused efforts on various areas, whether it happens to be because they want to develop an aquatic or a fishery of some sort, or whether there may be an industrial thing going on. So I guess there's some specifics. For instance, in the Red Devil area, they did a lot of work in there in terms of where the mercury sits within the streams that flow into the Kuskokwim and within the Kuskokwim. So there's some data there. However, in a generalized way, it would be rare that we would have a project ongoing that would have that kind of baseline data until the project came onto the radar. I'm not sure if that was a very good answer. It's basically that we don't have enough data.
Okay. I think we should push on.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
I would like you to address, though, Dr. Miller, the sixth element there.
Yep.
Actually, you passed that to me, Lance.
Mr. Rutherford.
So I think probably most of you have heard the term bond pool. A bond pool is simply a device where, in this case, the miners are given the opportunity to put money into a fund that will cover a large group of them for poor performance on reclamation. And all we're saying here is that the bond pool that's been set up specifically for the small miner, the placer miners tend to be the smallest group or the smallest operators, has worked very well, and we prefer not to see that go away. And one of the problems is the BLM is now suggesting that there will be a different method of bonding for the small miner. So our position is that we want to maintain that state bond pool for the small miners. That's our message. BLM hopefully will sit at the table with our state agencies and decide that that's still a workable scheme. We wanted to underline that in the last 25 years of several hundred operations per year, we've never had an incident that required going back to the bond pool. So they're relatively good operators.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, how long before it's returned, or is it returned at all if there was no use for it?
Good question. I think that the amount, correct me, Lance, if the amount that's in the pool has to stay at a certain level, and to some extent, then year by year, the amount asked the individual placer miners to ante up changes. But none of it's been returned, as far as I know, to the individual placer miners.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to page 5.
Okay. Thank you. So I guess the general comment on these is we all know the state is young and maturing, and due to a large amount of federal land and the amount of wetlands, I think it's really important to work with the federal government, for the legislature and administration, which, you know, you all are with our U.S. delegation and the present administration. So there's opportunities. We've talked about supporting your agencies who are doing a lot of this type of work. And so just, you know, quickly to go through some of these. Waters of the U.S., number 7, is something really to monitor. So, again, we're asking to support and monitor the federal legislation that defines waters of the U.S., according to the Clean Water Act. And then we'll just quickly go through these others so we can jump on. Rob, talk about 8 and 10.
Mr. Rutherford, you're going to give us 8 through 10.
Yeah, just number 8 and number, yeah. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yep. All right. Resource management plans, or RMPs, are a current concern to the Minerals Commission because the BLM has invoked these in some instances to essentially close areas to any further development. And we see that this process came into effect during the Obama era, and it's still rolling forward. So just as an example, they use the term ACEC, which is a area of critical environmental concern, as a method to lock up about 3 times as much area in the Central Yukon plan as they had in the past. And we think that that's, you know, essentially overreaching by the BLM. So we want to be sure that we as a state recognize this kind of thing. The U.S. delegation seems to be working on this very thing very well. And I know there are people here that appreciate that. So that's 8. That's our recommendation, is to just urge everyone to keep track of the process that BLM's going through, and that they need to keep in mind this is a multiple use area. We sort of have 2 areas that we wanted to bring out with regard to public land orders that are outdated, as well as 11, which is areas that of federal land withdrawals. We think in both cases that we need to work with the BLM to free those areas up to whatever multiple use they may have. In many areas, there is substantial mineral potential. So these areas, public land orders currently locked up in there or within withdrawals, that we need to keep the pressure on to BLM to free those up.
Okay. And then just touching on number...
Dr. Miller, back to you.
Oh, thank you. Number 10 is, and I, you know, we know you've all heard the John Sturgeon case and other efforts, and the state has been supportive of this, but as we all know, it's critical to have this access to state lands and the navigability issues. So, again, supporting that and for the legislature to continue to pursue access on these corridors to public lands. It goes for the Native Corps, private lands as well. Very important.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on to page 6.
Thank you. So here we can just sort of have hopefully a little fun and go quick. I want to touch on a few things. This map, and there's a new one out, but we don't have it. The takeaway here is you can see the red circles, serrated circles of the mines, the prospects, advanced exploration in diamonds, and the producing mines. But so there's basically 5 metal mines, 1 coal mine. There's been some studies that have been done by major mining companies to give you an idea of how many prospects it takes to get this number of mines producing. It, you have to evaluate on the order of 7,000 to 15,000 occurrences. So imagine that map with that many dots. The chance of occurrence turning into a mine is less than 1%. So I just want to leave that out there. It's for the odds. A couple slides here on timelines for mineral development. We have this broken down: successes, meaning mines in production, those in the process, like Donlin Creek, for example, and a few that have just been sort of shuttered, Rock Creek and AJ here behind you in town. The average, the takeaway here is, and it's really important to understand the difference between oil and gas and mining, of course, is to get to a bankable feasibility or decision to mine, based on Alaska experience, is around 16 years and $250 to $300 million. That's how much time and how much money it takes just to get to a decision to mine. The next slide puts the little the humans at the bottom, kind of put it in a perspective, the different stages of mineral development from exploration all the way to construction. Again, you know, someone can be born and basically turn into an adult in that time. So the long view that mining companies have is critical because it's just demanded. I won't go through all the detail. It's in your packet of the differences between the project stages. But I think they're really important because, again, a lot of what you hear about often are the exploration projects. Touching on competing for capital, I think we all appreciate this. It really is on a global stage. But also, and Rob and I were talking about this, it's, I think, two ways to look at it is, one, you need the capital at the exploration level. It's high risk, high return. Funding is erratic. Political regulatory environment is critical. Final feasibility stage, or basically when you're ready to make a decision to build a mine, the return becomes more profitable. It is a bit lower risk, if you can call mining business lower risk. Secure financing is more available, and you still need that stable political environment. So I think sometimes we lump these, but they are very distinct capital pools. And just to show, these two graphs are from Orion, which is a big private equity group, but it's showing global exploration dollars. You know, and the high was 2012 to today, and then mining equity, which would be the CapEx, similar time frame to today. And you can see it's, you know, decreased dramatically. Alaska is similar. Our numbers, what, for 2012-ish were about $300 million.
300.
Down to $50 million and
16. Yeah, actually, I think it was even lower.
Lower.
Yeah, it went lower then. It's risen up again.
And it's back up to maybe $90 million. So Alaska has really mimicked the global trend. But that's, you know, it's bottom takeaway here, it's a diminishing pool of dollars that all the jurisdictions are competing for. One of the other factors, of course, is the cyclicity of the metals. And this is kind of an interesting chart. It goes back to the 1740s. It's the commodity index. So whether you're, you know, it's oil or wheat or ham hocks or whatever. We know there's always a cyclicity. I think recently you can see the timeline is shortened, presumably because of communication, so markets go quicker. But still, it's up and down. And always like to talk about this. We all know it, but sometimes when we get to planning, we either plan on the highs or plan on the lows, and, you know. Just not reality. In fact, using a zinc example, and zinc is, of course, important for the state. It's the majority of the metal export, actually. And this graph goes back to the 70s. Red Dog came into production, as an example, in 89. And during that period, there's been three spikes. One we're seeing right now in 2018. The rest of the time, it was barely making money. In fact, Red Dog took about 14 years to pay back its capital, even though the feasibility said it'd be 3 to 7 years, because it went through that valley of death of zinc price. So,
Representative Rauscher has a question for you, Dr. Miller.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. We spoke about how planning for the spikes or the lows would be wrong, but can you plan on the timing? If you look at this map, you can see some intervals there which seem to follow some sort of pattern there. Would planning on the timing be a bad idea, or would preparing for that kind of timing not be a bad idea?
Yeah, through the chair. It would be a good idea if you can. And often the cycles are close to this. This is a little longer, zinc, but overall it's kind of an 8-year, you know, often cycle. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, and we're seeing this today, is let's use zinc. Zinc is up. There's all kinds of people wanting to explore. There's a deficit of supply. So then, you know, a bunch of, let's say, mines expand or more are found. There's more supply. then it'll decrease the cost. And then that exacerbates the timing. Also, it comes back to, you know, that earlier slide of how long it takes to bring something to fruition. Between the metal cycles, availability of capital, the permit timelines, all these things, it kind of turns those nice spikes into more chaos. So even though you plan on it, it's hard to get it done to capture. So maybe answer your question, though, is especially for base metals, what an operator likes to find is a deposit that will last long enough to be able to be in production across a couple cycles.
That follow-up.
Yes, follow-up. Thank you. Through the chair, so were the high spikes, do you have any idea whether those were due to global happenings? In other words, something happened within that period of time of those few years that are marked that actually, so it may not be just cyclical, but it may be due to actually events that seem cyclical.
Yes, and through the chair, maybe this next slide speaks to that a little bit. It only goes back a few years, but yes, I would say in general, it's the fundamentals of supply-demand. Sometimes if there's a world, you know, political event, socioeconomic thing, it will affect it. But what this slide shows is the price in blue, and then the gray line are the metal inventories. So basically, you know, it's kind of neat because as they go down, price goes up. And that the big spike in 07, that's what it was really too. Metal stocks were so low that there just wasn't enough out there for building cars and things like that. So the price went up.
I thank you. Appreciate it.
So, yeah, it was a great lead into this one. And then, you know, again, especially when you're looking at things like gold or zinc or copper that you can just produce and sell on the market, there is a demand. This slide with the pie chart speaks to zinc. It shows where the demand for zinc is, but also the consumption. So, you know, basically, there is global consumption that is still increasing. In fact, here's a little question. Does anybody have an idea of the per capita annual consumption of zinc worldwide? We all take our zinc.
In grams.
In grams. No, it can be in pounds.
Tons.
My committee's drawing a blank.
4 pounds.
4 pounds?
4 pounds. Yeah. I know. Kind of cool. Trivia. So, unless there's more questions on that, plowing ahead just a little bit on the mining companies. And what we have here is placer mines because they are important. They're the family farm, you know, Alaska. And they collectively make up the equivalent of one other large mine. And it's mostly gold. Investment strategy is really family livelihood. Then you have the juniors, the mid-tier, and the majors. And we have a few slides to talk a little bit more about each of those and examples of operators in the state. So the juniors, the industry has changed in the last 15, 20 years where the majors used to do their own exploration. They just do not anymore. So it's farmed out to these juniors. It's the high risk. They really are the discoverer of new deposits. They have small market caps. They're really totally dependent on equity markets, and they are high risk. Examples, Nova Gold, Trilogy, Millrock, Solitario, Constantine up by Haynes, International Tower, Hill by Fairbanks, Northern Dynasty, Pebble. Okay? Then you move to the mid-tiers, and they're a pretty small percentage of the mining sector. They're actually operators. They have fairly large market capitalization, sometimes to a few billion. They do have access to public money and to debt financing, banks, royalty firms. Examples are Hecla, Greens Creek, Yosemite, Hudbay, Lundin. I suppose Coeur would be in this too, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then major companies, often they do the larger projects. Often they're vertically integrated through transportation and fabrication, smelting. Large market caps, they can get low-cost debt and global. An example would be Teck, Barrick, who's one of the partners with Nova, Donlin, Anglo, Rio Tinto, BHP. MMG, Glencore, and Kinross at Fort Knox. So that just, to, you know, I think it's important to see where these different companies fit in the scheme of things and when you hear about them. So any questions? There's no questions on those. Then another aspect that had come up is infrastructure. And again, we are not suggesting what the state does on infrastructure. It's more of just what other jurisdictions has done and what Alaska has done. So in Canada, there's been three big infrastructure initiatives. You can read here, you know, Yukon Infrastructure, Roads and Bridges, $360 million Canadian. BC Hydro Transmission Line, Northwest BC, over $700 million. Road System in Ontario, $900 million. So these were all for mining and for rural development. Alaska, you know, typically the mining company builds its own, whether it's the Juno Hydro here, which started out of the AJ, you know, so Juno's Hydro, Copper River Railroad, Hatcher Pass, Great Recreation Area Mining, and the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. So often these end up with public benefits, and that's just not right or wrong. It just seems like that is the Alaska model, so it's just a different philosophy. Next, just the last couple slides here. Local benefits. This is a little hard to see, but I think even from here you can tell the difference. Focus on the red dots, which are communities with mining industry employees. And there was a downturn, of course, from 2012 to 14, and you can see, you know, half as many communities had jobs. So I think, you know, compared to almost any other industry for interior of Alaska, mining really does, as we know, provide those local jobs. You know, a NANA example, too, the benefits to the whole state, because these are new numbers through last fiscal year. NANA has received $1.7 billion in royalties, and as of last year, we've now distributed over $1 billion to all the other ANCs through 7I and 7J.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For this slide here, I've got to ask, do you know what's happened to the total number of people employed in the mines? Do you know what the numbers would be? I know in my town here, I've got a friend who works out at one of the mines, and he's moving with his family down to the Midwest because the shift accommodates it, you know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and the cost of living is lower. So I'd be interested in knowing what's happened between 2012 and today in terms of the proportion of resident versus non-resident workers and how many of these communities, how many of these jobs moved out of state, how many concentrated in larger communities, et cetera.
Sure. We can get back to you through the chair on that. I can't remember. I know the AMA has the numbers. It seems like it's around 3,000-4,000. I'm sure it's up since 2014, but as far as non-resident, I know it really varies by the mine. I'm not sure what it is here. Red Dog's, 80-some percent, I think. Alaska, do you have some numbers, Rob?
Unfortunately, it's still loading. It's coming from the DGGS's industry report. Minerals Industry Report does a very good job of talking about that. We did earlier take the numbers of the actual production and the actual exploration funds and so forth. I'm not sure if there's a good correlation, but obviously the more work that's done, the more dollars changing hands, the more people are working. So it looks like in the last, say, three-year period, whereas exploration dollars have bottomed out and come back slightly, the production side has leveled and maybe even dropped just a little bit, but stayed fairly high. $2.5 billion are the numbers that we
for total dollars.
Yeah, but quite a number of people, and I'm still struggling to find out whether it's 3,000 or 4,000 or some number like that probably applies to be directly related to mineral production.
But your question was really about the people moving out, and, yeah, we'll follow up.
Thank you. Okay.
Just the last two slides, want to kind of leave on two notes, I guess, maybe, or two slides. It often comes up, you know, where does Alaska sit? So in global mining investment attractiveness, this is the Fraser Institute, which does an annual survey, surveys hundreds of mining experts and executives from around the world, looking at the whole world, 91 jurisdictions. Alaska ranks 10 out of 91 overall, which is pretty good. But if you look at the next few bullets, why it ranks up high is because of the mineral potential, the geology. But if you look at the last bullet, the uncertainty of existing regulations and how those are fulfilled in the future, Alaska is 41 out of 91. And that really speaks to a lot of the recommendations in our report, you know, those policy issues, the environment. The geology is there. So,
Dr. Miller, let me ask you something, because I'm going to apply a stereotype here. And when I look at this as someone who taught world history and, you know, sort of knows what happened in the 19th and 20th centuries, and I look at South America and Africa, I mean, those were continents that were, I mean, I think it's fair to say they were exploited in some way. Certainly, that was part of the reason World War I happened, is, mm-hmm. you know, it's all sort of interconnected. So I'm surprised that they're noted as less attractive. I would have thought that because of economic pressure and civil war and all those other factors, that they would be more attractive to enter into for the explorer developer. So I'm just thinking of like a South African mine as a place where there may be less, and I could be wildly wrong, but maybe less regulation than we might see here, that sort of thing. And so that the industry might find that more inviting in some way.
Oh, okay, if I may. I actually worked a little bit in South Africa, and I managed projects in Russia for Placer Dome. So I'll just speak a little bit from my experience, but also from the industry, is the notion that a company will go in because, you know, there's less regulations, easier to do stuff, is, I think, just not a valid one in this day and age. The reason is, maybe for an explorer, you know, it can be, because they can be a little, you know, move in and test the waters, but as soon as a major gets involved, they have a global image to be out there, and their stock rides and falls on that. And there's an issue in the Congo with a company X, Y, and Z, and it's going to hit social media, and they could be, you know, really hurt their brand. Some of the financing, for example, tech is on the Dow Sustainability Index. You know, that's a big deal for them. Better cost of capital. I mean, you have to go by certain practices. So bigger companies, and eventually the juniors want to sell their deal to a bigger company, I just are not going to go somewhere where, you know, that's my take.
What does it mean when you say tech is on the sustainability index? What is that?
It's a Dow Jones index of companies that are kind of viewed as being, you know, trying to do their best practices. So sometimes they'll have access, the way I understand it, to sometimes lower cost of capital financing.
And so it's a sign that tech had to qualify some standard?
Correct.
They couldn't just say, we want to be on the
list. Exactly. No, they're, yeah, exactly, for clarification. Yeah, thanks.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and you see that all around when, you know, I worked for Placer Dome. We were a partner in Maricopa in the Philippines. They actually had an issue there. Placer Dome was 30%. Placer Dome was left with the bill for the cleanup. After that, they said, no way are we going to get into those kind of deals again. We'll be in control, because if you're the deep pocket, you want to be in control and make sure you have all the best practices, not relying on an operator.
Okay.
So, but it is, interesting. Right. And then lastly, here's just a local example. And I learned about this recently, but there was, in the 80s, there were issues over development and preservation in the Haines area. It was called the Haines Consensus. Pretty interesting story. This was resulted in subsequent legislation. You can see the statute up there that created the Bald Eagle Preserve and the Haines State Forest. And the people who came, signed on, were Lumber Company, Lynn Canal Conservation, SEAC, U.S. Wildlife Service, Audubon, I believe. Yep, Audubon was in there, the mayor. And to come together to solve an issue so you could have both development and preservation. So kind of the, we thought this was sort of a neat story. This is up where the Constantine Project is, of a way maybe to get back to try to work together, you know, bipartisanly to address some of these challenging issues and come up with solutions. So it's kind of a neat little story. So.
And Dr. Miller, I assume the story has a relatively happy ending, that this was created in 82, but it's being abided by and people are...
That's the goal. Yes, okay. It is. I think, you know, there has been some issues or some concerns over the exploration at Constantine, but, you know, it was... That mineral deposit was actually being explored at this time, so it's nothing new. So, yeah, that is maybe to your point. So far it's being abided by, but we'd like to remind people there are these frameworks in place.
So it sounds like Constantine is an example of what you said, that it the 16-18 year horizon or beyond.
Beyond. As just a side note, I know you've got to run, but one of my sons worked there a few years ago. And I worked there for Kennecott in 84. We were standing together on the helipad 30 years later, and the project is basically at the same level of exploration, a little more.
Deja vu moment. Okay, any closing questions for these gentlemen? Yes, Representative Lincoln.
Questions. I'm just curious, so the commission was came together to create this report and some recommendations, but could you just briefly describe what's the next steps here? I mean, you're presenting to us and you're sharing the information with the administration, but I mean, what sort of follow-up is like expected on some of these priorities?
Thank you for that question. And that's a good one. I don't have an answer. Honestly, we come together. It is, you know, basically volunteer. It is volunteer. So we work hard to put this together. We make the presentations, but I think one thing on the commission we've talked about is doing more follow-up, especially with the agencies, to keep these recommendations moving. Because a lot of us, we just go back to our day jobs, and once we're done, it kind of puts on the shelf. So maybe I would ask, the legislature, if there's things that they really want us and would be interested to follow up and we could help push, that would be, we'd be very open to that.
Yeah. That provokes some questions. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that point, I know that the top priority of the Alaska Mineral Commission is the establishment of a stable state fiscal policy. If there's something you want to advocate for, I'd certainly welcome the help.
And Representative Birch.
I just want to take this opportunity, Mr. Chair, to thank the commission members that are here and the commission efforts and initiative over the years and keeping us on track. And, it's very helpful to have this kind of a dialogue on an annual basis and kind of get a reassessment of where we're at and where we're going. And I particularly like the closing slide there, because I have met with some of the Constantine folks, and they have actually talked about how helpful this has been to have some of that structure and negotiation out of the way first. So, great brief. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We're now going to move on to House Bill 355. In the room for House Bill 355, we have the bill's sponsor, Representative David Guttenberg, and his aide, Aliana Salangit. Also in the room with us is State Forester Chris Mesh, I believe DNR Fire Program Manager Tom Kurth. Although I don't. Online. I see Mr. Kurth online. And on the phone from the Department of Law, in case we have any questions, is Ann Nelson, who led the drafting of the bill. And so those are the five individuals we have. Representative Guttenberg, if you'll come forward. And and you're welcome to bring staff if you need her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff is very familiar with this, but I think estimation, the folks online are...
Okay.
So House Bill 355 seeks to modernize the laws dealing with forest fires and people that are delinquent or negligent, and update the statute so that the division can of forestry can do a better job on investigating fires and citing people appropriately. We've had, and actually, one of the interesting parts of it is it allows the division director or somebody in the department to decide when extended fire season is, because we have problems, and that is a situation that we have. Fire seasons might lapse. Things are going along or starting earlier than traditionally they have been. And the bill addresses gaps in enforcement. Over the last 15 years, the seasons have been extended. There are goal is to reduce risk and be more appropriate in how we're approaching the investigative side of the equation. So that is my sponsor summary, and we can go from there, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Do members at this point, we're in a real introductory part here, but do members have any questions at this point? Okay. Yes, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chairman Justin. Through the chair, I was just wondering, there's some private land access in this bill, right?
Yes.
And could you speak to that?
Well, and I asked that question this morning. I addressed that exact issue. And I think Ann Nelson is online, and she would do a much better job than I could. But
thank you.
But that's exactly what I approached this morning.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Did you want to repeat that? Or?
There's some in this bill, I believe there's some private land access issues that are in the bill that I would like to just have explained.
Okay. Perhaps we should do that after we hear something from Director Mache. Let's do it that
okay.
way. Okay. So, Director Mache, do you want to this looks like a joint effort to me. Okay. You want to go ahead and take the helm?
Yes. For the record, my name is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry and State Forester, and I am here today to speak in support of this legislation. This bill, as the representative is describing, is really about reducing human-caused wildland fire and human risk. And I'll talk more specifically about that, but this bill was last addressed in the many, many decades ago, so it's the first modernization of this statute in many years. And what it does is a couple of things. It would allow us to have a more tiered approach to enforcement when that is needed. But one of the key things of this bill is also stressing the education aspect of our prevention program. Our prevention officers are first firefighters, and then second wildland fire investigators to investigate cause and responsibility for wildland fire, and then we use that to seek fiscal recovery when a situation is appropriate, either through the criminal or the civil process. The prevention staff are peace officers by definition, but they are not badge-carrying or gun-toting peace officers. Their training only goes to the point that if they get into a situation where it's a difficult one, they are trained to back off, contact the state troopers, and work with the state troopers to proceed as needed in that kind of a situation. Specifically, to get to the question that Representative Rauscher had, as far as right to enter land, we already have that right in state statute for the actual suppression, control, and prevention of wildland fire. And so that's already in statute. We are not making any changes in this bill other than to clarify that we also have that right for investigative purposes. And I can explain a little bit about that. When a fire starts on private lands, we'll enter those lands to suppress, and that often includes determining the point of origin. It's not always on the land that we enter, but it may be somewhere further away, so we have to follow that back and investigate where the fire began and how it began as part of the control and suppression efforts. And it's just making clear that investigative piece is included in the terminology that we used in the previous statute. So hopefully that answers your question.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up. Representative Rauscher.
Appreciate it. Through the chair. The I guess what I want to know is, it's my understanding that you, if this bill was to go forward as it sits, the a private property, a private piece of property, wherever this investigation is to be held, gives up their rights to you asking for permission to investigate. Is that correct?
Through the chair, representative, let me explain what we have right now, and then I'll explain what this this bill is suggesting. Right now, we have the right to enter into control and suppress wildland fires. That's AS 4115040, and it specifically talks about for the purpose of preventing, suppressing, or controlling a wildland fire or a destructive agent. And those terms are then defined in the definition sections that's appropriate for this statutory language. If you go on a little bit further in the section, you'll come to, I believe it is Article 6. And hang on just a minute here while I look that up. Yep, it's Article 6, General Provisions. It's 4115950, and it talks about the definition of a peace officer, who has the ability to enforce this statute, which are any of the employees in the department authorized by the commissioner. That's my prevention. Staff and firefighters. It also says a police officer of the state. We often work with the state fire marshal's office in the same capacity. And you can see there as it goes on down through that section, we do not have the authority to execute a warrant, but we do have the authority to request a warrant from an officer or court of competent jurisdiction. So if there is an immediate situation where there is a fire and we need to enter to suppress or control, we currently have the right to enter private lands. At subsequent to after control of a fire, we would have to work through the process that's outlined for normal investigative process with the state troopers or the district attorney's office.
Do the follow-up?
Follow-up.
So this is after the fire is out, mm-hmm. Now you want to investigate. I just want to work on that part. I'm really concerned with all the other parts of it. So once the fire is out and now we're into an investigation mode to figure out what actually happened, this bill allows you to go on property without seeking a court order or permission. You could just go on property now and investigate, or am I wrong here?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for the purpose of after the fire is controlled, we do not have authority to enter without permission. Most of the time, people are cooperative with that. If someone were to tell us we are not allowed to enter the property, then we would have to work through the proper authorities to request a search warrant and then proceed accordingly.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
After or before the bill, what you say?
Yes, through the chair, representative. That's currently how it works. The only change we're making is an investigative piece, but it's in context with the rest of the statute that already exists. And so what I described would be practice with current statute and the suggested change. It just clarifies that for investigative purposes, during the actual time of fire, we also have that right to enter. Right now, that's a catch-all under the prevention piece, if you will, so it's a clarification of that aspect.
Perhaps you could show, tell us the section again where the clarification occurs.
Yes, that's actually in the new bill, so let me, I think it's section 3 and 4, if I remember right. Section 3.
Okay.
Is where the word is added. And to clarify that, prevention right now includes investigation, but it's not explicitly spelled out, so that's the reason it's being explicitly spelled out in this section.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
So the way it was explained to me is there's a fire now. They have the right to, in their normal course of events, to find out the source or other things in order to be able to put out the fire. Sometimes there's not an investigator there. And if an investigator wants to come back at a later time, he needs permission or a court order, right? Or a, so And forestry people are trained to not be confrontational, and they would come back with a trooper or somebody that was capable of issuing a court order or to get permission to be on property for purposes of investigating.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. Presently, is it a fire marshal that would investigate that? How do we take care of those investigations right now existing before this legislation? I just want to understand the process. Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. Right now, we have full investigative authority within the Division of Forestry. So we have people that are trained in wildland fire investigation, origin and cause of wildland fire. More complicated fires, we may enlist the aid of the State Fire Marshal's Office and some of their investigators. It depends on the circumstances of the fire and potentially whether structures were involved at the point of origin. We are not trained to do structure investigations, just wildland fire. Typically, we have investigators in each of our area offices. They're part of our regular fire program staff, so they are, as I said earlier, firefighters first, but they're also trained in this particular set of skills.
Take a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So what do you need here that you don't have in this Section 3? In other words, I'm just trying to get a grasp on why it's here, sure, trying to understand the purpose of its need, and trying to understand what you have been lacking that this needed to cover.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, it's really just adding the clarification about the investigating aspect of it. It is before, as I said, part of the prevention piece. It's an older piece of terminology. These laws go back to the early 60s, and so we are making it very clear that investigating a fire's cause and origin is also covered under this statute. And if I might suggest, you might check in with the Department of Law here. Ms. Nelson may have some clarification she could offer on this topic.
Is she online?
She is. Ms. Nelson, would you like to contribute anything to this discussion?
Thank you. This is Ann Nelson from the Department of Law, through the chair. The only comment I would add to this is that the statute, the proposed amendment to the statute wouldn't have any impact on the constitutional law that applies to investigative searches and those privacy protections. It really is just clarifying the nature of the activities that Division of Forestry already undertakes when they're doing a fire investigation or responding to an active burn.
So, through the chair, I'm really running out of ways to get what I want to understand, and I apologize for my unable to convey. But right now, there's a forest fire, and it took out a few houses along the way. They suppressed it. What does the clarification need to do that they couldn't get clarity on before, I guess what I'm saying? I understand it needs clarity. It designs clarity, but I don't understand the clarity it designs, is what I'm saying.
Through the chair,
yes.
Representative
Rauscher.
Yes, it's really about making it clear to someone when they look at this statutory language that this investigation aspect is one of the pieces that is afforded the division under this statute. It has been afforded under the prevention terminology that was used in the past. Mm-hmm. And so it's really an effort to make this for a layperson or anyone else that reads a statute to be able to understand that investigating the cause and origin of the fire is actually an aspect of this. That's really the intent, is just trying to make it easier for people to understand that is an activity that is covered.
Representative Birch and then Lincoln.
Just for thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think just for clarity, we've had some horrific fires started by fireworks in the Mat-Su, just devastated, you know, thousands and thousands of acres and ruined lots and lots of lives and property. And I think if I understand this, what it's saying is that not only is somebody entitled to come on a property where they think the fire may have started and put down the fire, but if they happen to see during the course of figuring out why this thing started, they're poking around and finding stuff that would be permissible and acceptable and usable in a court of law down the line, that the investigation doesn't have to be separately accounted for. And it seems clear to me, and it seemed very entirely appropriate that could happen concurrently. And it seems reasonable to me that at the same time you're knocking the fire down, you're sitting there going, what started this conflagration to begin with? And I think this provides that clarity.
Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question along those lines. So does this section apply to fires that have been suppressed, or is it just you're actively fighting a fire? And part of that is, like Representative Birch said, part of fighting it is understanding the source of it or investigating what happened. But is the expectation that once the fire is suppressed and you're going back to the scene to investigate it further, at that point would you need to get the a prior approval or a warrant or something, or is this only to apply to active fires?
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln. Yes, this is a suppressing, we would say controlled, because suppressing is an actual function of putting the fire out. So control is after the fire has been suppressed, we were successful, and is out. And that is if we have permission from the landowner, we can proceed with an investigation. If we do not have permission from the landowner, that's when we would have to involve law enforcement and seek a warrant for that type of activity to continue.
Okay. All right. If you want to continue.
Yes, some of the other key aspects of the bill, probably the most important aspect, is it provides us a three-tiered enforcement tool to use when we have violations of the burn regulations. Currently, we only have a misdemeanor and a felony charge in current statute, and those are only through violations of those statutes and have to be coordinated with the district attorney and is a mandatory court appearance. So it's a rather cumbersome process to deal with minor infractions of the burning regulations. So, therefore, we typically will issue warnings and only go through the violation process for the most egregious type of offenses due to the amount of time that takes and the amount of time it takes in the courts. This bill would give us a three-tier process, with the first tier being essentially akin to a traffic ticket. It would establish authority for us to go through a regulatory process and then have the Supreme Court approve a bail schedule that would essentially be like issuing a traffic ticket. It would have predetermined amounts for different types of infractions of the regulations and could be settled simply by paying the fine amount. There's no criminal record for the settlement of a bail-covered offense. It then adds a misdemeanor offense and then two felony-level offenses, so that's where we come with the three tiers. I won't go into the details of the misdemeanor. I think it's a Class A, if I remember correctly, and the felonies are B and C offenses. They're just higher-level offenses and have higher fine amounts associated with those offenses. One of the other important things this bill does is it makes it very clear where the discretionary immunity statute applies, in particular to two types of firefighting techniques we commonly use, which are referred to as either burnouts or backburns. The current legislation uses the term backburn, which is more of an older term. The more modern term is burnout, so the term burnout is added to that section. And it makes it clear that those types of activities are under the auspices of the discretionary or civil immunity statute that is in this section already.
Mr. Mesh, or Director Mesh, was there a lawsuit brought against the division or against firefighters?
Mr. Chair, since I've been director and even prior to that, I guess the lawsuit that would come to mind would be the Miller's Reach fire, if you are familiar
sure.
with that one. That's probably the biggest challenge that we've had to a discretionary immunity statute. And, in fact, after that incident, I think the discretionary immunity statute was strengthened, if I recall. But that was before my time as a part of the Division of Forestry. Certainly my chief of fire Tom Kurth may be able to speak to that. He was in the division at the time, but that was not in his area. That was up in or over in the valley is where that occurred. Tom was up in the interior at that time. So since that time, we've never had any specific challenge on the discretionary immunity piece. And that's because it's a pretty clear statute, and it provides that discretion and immunity unless we do something that's beyond our training or knowledge base. And then, of course, we can be held negligent just like anybody else in a professional capacity. So rest of it is probably I would call housekeeping. There's a lot of old terminology, such as the it refers to Division of Mining, Land, and Water. We did not exist when the statute was first written as the Division of Forestry. So now we get our day in the sunlight as actually a division. It fixes other old terms and just brings the whole statute into a more standard format for how this type of statute is written and the terms that describe the statute. And those are probably the key points. I don't know if there's anything else that the representative would like to add.
Well, the Representative Frosch's point.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's you don't lose any rights, right? The constitutional rights of property are still there. If you don't give permission, this is after the fact. The firefighters are gone. The hoses are rolled up. The trucks are gone. Investigator who might not have been there has to come back. Still needs permission or a court order to cross the property or beyond the or even cross the property. And the divisions doesn't have personnel to do that. They would bring in law enforcement. But other than that, it is just setting up the three tiers, which I think makes it deals with different levels of responsibility or just the fine for causing a fire. And it's just bit, and the rest of it is modernization.
Okay. So I began sort of a thorough look at this, and I saw, for example, on page one, we were deleting AS 4115-150, which is a very old law, and it gave a 1 to 10 year imprisonment where there was a malicious or wanton setting of a fire. Are we still covering that sort of misconduct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Chris Mace again, Director of the Division. Yes, that is addressed in probably those would raise to a felony or an arson-type charge, so those would be covered under those two felonies that are addressed in this specific piece of legislation. It could also raise to a misdemeanor. It just depends on the seriousness of the offense. But, yes, those are still chargeable-type offenses.
And are we still making setting sort of differences between really malicious and wanton conduct, or we're not sweeping all of the type of misconduct into one felony? Are we still making a separation between the accidental setting of a fire and the deliberate and wanton or malicious setting of a fire?
Yes, there's still a differentiation between those types of circumstances.
Okay. Other questions from the committee on 355? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a change to permits. The commissioner shall, by regulation, prescribe the conditions and the manner for obtaining a permit for the setting of fires, use of burning devices, and other activities or uses of land that increase fire danger.
And you're reading from Section 6.
On page 2, yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
The language deleted was obtaining a permit. Failure to obtain the required permit or violation of a condition of a permit is a misdemeanor. So growing up, we used a burn barrel a lot where there's national forest right behind the house. Would this change our ability to burn off surplus cardboard, newspaper, et cetera?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, no, it doesn't change your ability to use a burn barrel. However, it does make it clear the burn barrels are covered under the seasonal permit that's required. Right now, that permit is required during the statutory designated fire season, which is April 1st through August 31st. And during that time, we have a burn permit that's required if you want to conduct outdoor burning of any type. And there's different types all the way up through agricultural burning. You just have to abide by the regulations and the standards set by that permit. The key thing is each day you have to call in to see if it's a safe day to burn, and that is established by areas around the state, by our area offices. Each day our fire management officers are looking at fire weather, fire danger, fuels, staffing, all the things that we should think about as an agency to whether we should say it's a safe day to do open burning or not a safe day. And when it's not a safe day, we will actually close it for that day. So as a permit holder, which you can get online, it's very easy to go get your permit. It used to be in person, but we modernized that, and you just go online and get it or stop in any of our offices if you don't have computer access. That's one of the key requirements, that you check each day and abide by the regulations with cleared soil, you know, a proper burn barrel that has the screen on it, the venting, you know, all that good stuff. So, no, it does not prevent you from doing it, just perhaps the day you do it.
Thank you.
Yes, Director Mish, the language that Representative Parrish mentioned that is deleted at the top of page 3, what would happen under this bill where there was a failure to obtain the required permit?
Well, it wouldn't be much different than it is right now, unless, let me explain how we would deal with that right now. If you do not have a permit and a prevention officer is called and comes to check a smoke report, as we would call it, typically you would get a warning unless you're a repeat offender. If it's someone we checked on earlier in the week or advised earlier in the day that it was not a safe day to burn, you didn't have a permit, here's how you go get one, and we came back later in the day and same thing, still no permit, we would consider actually a violation under current statute. At least the officer would have that option. Under this change, that would fall most likely under the bail schedule that we're asking to establish, which is a minor offense. It's really an education effort, and someone's a repeat offender, we'd like to have a bit of a way to remind them that they need to be cognizant of the danger when they're burning without a permit, and at a time they should not be burning, and the potential risks associated with that. So we could, under this bill, issue a citation.
But you could no longer cite them with a misdemeanor?
Not if we use the bail schedule. The misdemeanor would be for a more serious offense, so that might be someone that actually had a fire escape their property and did damage to another person's property. It's a Class A misdemeanor. I'm not the expert on what type of offense would rise to that, but we could certainly ask Ann if she had any additional input on the topic.
Ann, this is Representative Josephson. Looking at the, or rather Ms. Nelson, this is Representative Josephson, and at the top of page 3, it looks like we're reducing the penalty, but I've seen that we do that some because it either isn't ever used or it's more sort of manageable through a bail schedule. Is that what's going on?
Thank you, Chair Josephson. This is Ann Nelson with the Department of Law. To elaborate a little on Chris's response, all of the offenses that are identified in starting with Section 6 and on through the new Section 140, which is Section 15,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Would say that violations of any of those are a Class A misdemeanor. Hmm. Or if it's a violation of a regulation that's adopted under that section, it will be either a bail schedule offense, which means it's payable by, it's can be resolved by paying a fine, or it's a mandatory court appearance misdemeanor. So that gets to the two tiers that Chris was talking about earlier. So with the burn barrel, or with the permits example, Section 6 would make it a misdemeanor to not have to have that permit. However, depending on what the regulations look like and how the Supreme Court applies their bail schedule authority, offenses under that provision could be handled with payment of bail, so, and not be a criminal not be criminal in nature.
Okay. Chair? Yes. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I appreciate your question. Maybe if we could just follow up on that. So what we're talking about with bail schedule is we go to a violation which would be non-criminal, doesn't require a court appearance, and could be just basically a fee and fine schedule. And right now you said Class A misdemeanor. So in order for someone to – and I'm just – maybe you can help us here. I hope I'm not talking out of turn, but in order for one of our enforcement people to write one of those, the potential maximum fine is like 30 days in jail and $25,000 for Class A misdemeanor. Do I have that correct? That maybe I think I see the common sense here in actually having this to where it's not likely that someone forgets to buy their permit and one of our enforcement agents wants to write that serious a citation. Am I headed down the right road here?
Through the chair, this is Ann Nelson again. Absolutely. The there's a limit. I think the bill calls for $5,000 being the upper limit for the bail schedule.
That's correct.
Offense. This would be in Section 21. But anything that approaches a criminal type penalty would be a mandatory court appearance, criminal offense. So they would have to go through the Division of Forestry and the person who was issued the citation. That engages a criminal process that requires a mandatory court appearance for those kind of criminal penalties. The violations, the bail schedule offenses, are kind of the first tier of an awareness prevention and light enforcement, if you will, sort of approach to managing safe burning practices and responding to the minor incident.
So, Ms. Nelson, this is Andy Josephson again. Did the court system already, in anticipation of this legislation, add to the bail schedule as to fire prevention and violations of fire prevention or the fire code?
Chair Josephson, thank you for that question. No, the Supreme Court needs statutory authority. They need specific legislative authority to establish a bail schedule, and that's contained in Section 21B of this bill.
I see. Okay. All right. Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a decision that's made in the bill a couple of times to change from the laws as currently written, Section 4115-150, that is Section 16 of the bill. A person who maliciously or wantonly sets on fire, timber, brush, grass, or other inflammable material is replaced by burning forested land. Is there, if I were to start a fire in the tundra, would the law be any different for me?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, forested land is actually defined in the definition section, and it's any burnable organic material, essentially.
Nice.
It's pretty broad.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Including farmland?
Through the chair, Representative, burning organic material, yes, sir.
A wooden house.
Yes. Well, that gets into the structure side of things, and that's not our bailiwick.
Okay.
But,
thank you.
But I could say if a burning house started a wildland fire, which sometimes we will respond and keep that from happening, but we do not fight the structure fire itself.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions for the panel before us? Or for the Department of Law, or for Mr. Kurth, for that matter. Let's not forget him. He's the fire program manager for the division in Fairbanks.
And I might say, if I can, Mr.
Yes.
Kurth has some of our fire prevention statistics and also some examples of different types of project fires and potential risk. This is really about reducing that risk and trying to make our communities safer. So if you do have questions along those lines, he's prepared to discuss some of that information.
Okay. Representative Parrish, did you have another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Where would I find that definition?
I'll look it up here for you. I think
I've got 41.
Yeah.
Title 41 in front of me here.
I'll tell you in a second. Definition is 4115-170-3. Forest land includes all land on which grass, brush, timber, and other natural vegetative material grows.
Okay, yeah, there it is. Okay, so any place with
natural vegetative, organic material is what I would call that, but it doesn't use the word organic. It says natural vegetative. So if you had artificial vegetative, I don't know what that means.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. So if I'm on tideland and there's some beach grass and some seaweed, that's forested land, and I should be very cautious about setting a fire, huh?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I would interpret that to be the correct concern, and I would be very cautious.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, let me take a brief at ease. Representative Guttenberg and Ms. Ellen Geet, tonight we are scheduled to be taking public testimony on your bill. I invite you to join us for that. Is there any sense from the committee, just as we sit here now, whether members would like to spend more time studying this bill, offering amendments to the bill? We can hold the bill till Monday, for example, and in all likelihood dispose of it favorably at that time, if that's a preference. Yes, Representative Rauscher.
When would you want any amendments in by?
Well, we're reminded that Ledge Legal is entitled to have some time off. Go figure. So I think amendments to 355 would be by 5 p.m. on Friday, because otherwise you're setting them up for weekend work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Johnson, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was going to ask that you would hold it and give us an opportunity to take another look at it. So,
all right. So here's where we are then. We're going to, this evening at 6, I think we can meet relatively quickly. We're going to take public testimony on the criminal negligent burning bill that we've just heard about. And we'll also be hearing public testimony on Representative Millett's House Bill 367 on contaminated lands. We have not received any amendments to that bill. We'll see how many people are signed up to testify. And we'll, of course, take public testimony on both bills. Yes, tonight's meeting will be the last meeting of the committee this week. On Monday, we'll talk about food policy and hear from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commissioners about legislation they'd like us to consider. Wednesday, we'll discuss outdoor recreation. I think there's also a lunch and learn about outdoor recreation. There's a resolution on that, and that is HCR 25. And we'll also hear House Bill 272 on Wednesday. Friday of next week, we'll revisit HCR 25 on outdoor recreation and delve ever so gently into flame retardants. So if there are no other matters to come before the committee, we will we're going to adjourn this meeting and convene the other meeting at 6 p.m. Okay?
Thank you.
Is it 7 or 6? 6 p.m. We're adjourned here at 2:37.